Hey everybody, this is Trevin with the Scene Stealers podcast. This morning I'm here with Trey Hawk and Eric Moline.
Hi.
Hey buddy. Buddies. And we got a lot going on today. We've got a lot of movies. So we're going to start with Killing Them Softly, but we've also got Anna Karenina, Jack and Diane, and Miami Connection, the movie that Drafthouse Films has found and decided to put in their theaters.
So. Yeah, all four movies opening today in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Some of them, Anna Karenina, I believe, opened in limited release already.
Yeah, that's true.
As well as Jack and Diane has slowly been limping across the country.
Limping across the country. Is that a reference to the movie? Is it about handicapped person? Or
no.
Anything?
Okay. No.
I don't know anything about it.
No.
And I don't want to.
Okay. Well, then you'll really be looking forward to
it. I am.
Review.
I can't wait for you to tell me all about this movie. I don't want to know anything about it, so I'm just going to plug my ears and go under the desk.
Trevor and I saw Killing Him Softly, which is the new Andrew Dominik film.
Mm-hmm. I was there.
We all three were there too.
Yeah. I forgot Trey was there.
So all
this
three
is going to be fun.
We're going to start the movie that we all three saw this week because so many are going on that we're just having to kind of pick up each other's slack, mostly mine. But I did, and we all three were lucky enough to get to see, at least I think, lucky enough to get to see Killing Them Softly, the new movie from Andrew Dominik, who it stars Brad Pitt, which is, you know, the big thing to mention at the top.
Even though he doesn't show up for a half an hour.
No, which is awesome. Brad Pitt's starring role. Andrew Dominik is one of my favorite writer-director people. He is responsible for one of my favorite movies, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And he makes these really interesting, at least to me, again, you know, from my perspective, I think he makes really interesting undersung movies that don't really get the critical praise out of the gate, but I feel like they haven't really found the audience that I wish they would.
They're always about criminals.
Yeah. And Assassination of Jesse James is just one of my favorite movies about, you know, like the man behind the legend making, and then it gets into sort of even hero culture and sort of celebrity obsession by the end, even during the time that all those events take place in the film.
Chopper has really similar themes. Chopper from 2000, mm-hmm, with Eric Bana. Mm-hmm.
And now we've got this, Killing Them Softly, which is kind of, it's a very overt allegory. The movie coincides with the financial collapse and then sort of, I guess, is kind of the coda is Barack Obama's DNC acceptance speech in 2008. And it's really just about small-time crooks and the sort of shit that they have to go through to get the job done.
Does it end with his acceptance speech or does it end with his election?
I thought it was the DNC acceptance speech, but it could have been the election speech. I guess it.
Trey, do you remember?
I don't remember. Either of them were similar in tone, but yeah.
It would be more appropriate if it were his election night acceptance speech, but for some reason I thought it was the DNC speech.
If criminals in real life ever watched or listened to this many political speeches in one movie before, I would be surprised. It's obviously it's something that's used in the background, but I think the only real detriment to this film, because I really enjoyed it as well, was the fact that I thought that was terribly obvious.
Yeah,
and a little heavy-handed.
It's extremely heavy-handed. But even the way that they introduce it, I mean, like you said, it's always presented through media in the background, either a guy's listening to the radio or there's a big heist, not a big heist, but there's a small, like, amateur heist at the start of the movie.
And they're watching C-SPAN, of course.
Well, somewhere in the background. it may not have been C-SPAN. I mean, honestly, like,
yeah,
when all the collapse was going, I mean, you couldn't really get away from it. It was on every news channel.
Yeah.
And especially, like, an older generation tends to listen to the radio more. So I didn't have a problem with, you know, talk radio or someone in the car with a dumpy car too, with the radio on. I mean, for about 6 months there, I mean, you couldn't really get away from the fallout.
And then to further let him off the hook, I suppose one would never call this movie realistic. It has elements of realism in it where you spend time with really these low life criminals who are at the bottom of the barrel. Guys played by Scoot McNairy is our main character, who was so good in that movie Monsters.
Yeah.
Did you ever see that? And then Brad Pitt calls in James Gandolfini to help him clean up this mess.
There's
and you know, that guy is just a complete mess as well.
And then there's Richard Jenkins, who is just one of my favorite character actors ever. And he's
as understated as he could possibly be in this movie.
And that's what I was going to say, is that the most of when we hear the political overtones of this film come when you're sitting in Richard Jenkins' Prius or hybrid car or whatever it is, because Richard Jenkins is the go-between between these various criminal bosses.
But it opens with Obama narration, and it doesn't have a radio on or a TV or anything.
I'll give you that. And then at the end, I mean, what I was going to get to is, you know, I thought it was a little more subtle in its build-up, although, you know, you can still – it's obvious what Dominic's going for. But the only time where I felt like he just totally put all of his cards on the table is the end.
Yeah. Well, it has one of the greatest endings of any movie.
His main character just gives a speech that basically, you know, like The Wire is one of my favorite shows, and there are several times in The Wire where eventually, like, David Simon and Ed Burns will just drop all pretense and have one of their characters say exactly what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how this movie ends.
But it does come from this character's mouth and almost feels organic from what we've learned of him. So it's not like this serious.
And that's
offense.
Really, no. You know, that's really kind of my take on this film. Is this film is a film that is made in some ways to make a point.
Yeah,
it's kind of getting into an argument, but that argument is never, even though it's overt, we see what's going on, it always feels like it's coming from the characters in the movie for the most part. Like
we're
those
in
characters,
a hopeless situation.
Those characters you feel really strongly about, from the two sort of bumbling small-time criminals that get in way over their head, to the two hitmen played by Brad Pitt and Gandolfini. Where Brad Pitt is totally together and just, you know, he's a businessman. Right. When it comes right down to it, he is a businessman.
He's a guy that's good
and
at his
job. And it
just
happens to be that his business is being a hitman.
And it's great because his business is mired by the same stuff that other businesses are, the bureaucracy, yes men, people who just don't get it and don't seem to understand.
And
Gandolfini, and I loved all those exchanges.
Gandolfini
too.
Is a perfect foil to Pitt because Gandolfini is a little bit older. He's been strung out by the business of this whole thing. He's having problems with his wife.
He's gone up the river a couple
of
times.
And that's one of the things that I think makes this movie work, both as far as its argument and as far as just being a really great story, is that it develops its character down to these sort of minute, tragic, terrible little details.
All these things that we're saying, I should remind listeners at this point, we're dancing around the main point of what I think we need to get across in this review.
Go for it, then.
Which is that this movie is not a standard crime thriller by any means.
No.
This is a movie that is obsessed with long scenes that play out slowly. It's obsessed with disgusting, filthy dialogue by bottom-of-the-barrel, low-life people that reveals something and is also bleakly funny.
Yeah. Terribly
like
funny.
Like Seven Psychopaths was really funny this year, and I thought that was really dark and bleak. But this movie like throws that in the toilet. I mean, this is
total
just,
gallows humor.
Yeah, and total it's just there's nothing redeeming about any of the characters in this movie except for maybe the Brad Pitt one.
Yeah.
And not only at times.
And only because he's and only because what you said
because
before about
code.
Him being a businessman.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when he finally does give up the goat in the end of the movie, which by the way, the three best endings of any movie this year. Killer Joe, this movie, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Yes, I'm saying it. Awesome. So, people out there, you might want to check those out.
See, that sounds like a
but
new
you're
top
right.
10 list.
This,
yeah, it does.
This movie is made not to just, you know, get asses in seats, but to challenge its viewers.
Oh, and it will. They're marketing it as a mainstream crime thriller. I watched the trailer for the first time after the movie, and I was like, wow, whoever edited this together did a great job of selling a movie that does not exist.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This movie is not
what it is. Well, it's kind of like the American trailers for Drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it's like, that's not that movie.
And and we should mention, I did mention stylistic stuff before. I do want to get into this really quick. And when I say really quick, I mean 30 seconds. There are three cinematic bravura if I can say that, cinematic scenes in this film that will just blow you away. And they're not realistic. In fact, they're very specific and very artsy and pretentious or whatever. But, I mean, there are some unforgettable, like there are in all of his movies, unforgettable scenes.
Yeah.
This is essentially, if we had to put a genre on it, an art house version of a crime thriller. But it's based on this book by George V. Higgins. This guy knows dialogue. He knows lowlifes. And I don't know. This is for me, this is a solid rock fist up, maybe a rock fist way up.
It's a way up for me.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, it's of all the movies I've seen this award season, it's my favorite right now.
Definitely a solid rock fist up for me. I mean, there were a couple of moments that weren't bad at all. They were great, but yeah. It just didn't feel, you know, quite as consistent. Like, this wasn't start to finish perfect for me,
yeah.
But it's still excellent. I mean, and it's exciting to see a challenging film.
Did I give Lincoln a rock fist way?
Yeah, yeah, you've given way more movies.
Yeah.
Well, Life of Pi and Silver Linings.
Yeah.
You've said less favorable things about.
All right, rock fist way up.
It's too late.
Yeah. It's too late.
You said it out loud. It's done.
Yeah, you're on the Alan Rapp train.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what that means.
Well, that just means overinflating. You great inflation.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get Alan in here to do a sequel to this podcast.
Okay, with Trey. Where everything's a rock fist way up and mine a rock fist down.
Actually, this will give us a very nice transition, a quick one to this movie, Jack and Diane.
There we go.
Which Alan is reviewing for the site, and he called it the worst movie of the year.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I don't.
What is it even about?
I don't 100% agree with him, but basically what it is we were talking about pretentious and artsy-fartsy with Mr. Dominic.
Yeah.
This movie is about two young women in New York City. One of them is there just for the summer. From overseas, and they fall in love, and one of them is definitely a lesbian, and the other one is bicurious, possibly.
Yeah. Okay. Until graduation day.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Juno Temple. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Plays the one from overseas, the girl from overseas, and she was so good in Killer Joe this year. But anyway,
you really loved Killer Joe.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be in my top 10. So, The story is essentially about these two girls kind of finding out who they are, and letting their guard down enough to have a relationship and tell each other secrets and all the things that you do when you're circling, when you're young and you're circling somebody else and you're trying to figure out how this exchange works. And what happens is in the middle of this, there are sequences that suggest that either or both of them may be werewolves.
Huh.
That's so weird because from the trailer, it has this total, like, Michel Gondry vibe. It has this, who did Across the Universe? I'm blanking.
I selectively
forgot.
Julie Taymor.
But it's got that type of vibe, and it just doesn't win at all. Like, there's none of that. It doesn't...
Bradley Rust Gray is the director of this movie, but the directors of the stop-motion werewolf sequences are the Brothers Quay.
Okay.
So, who are known for their music videos things like that. So, those sequences are interesting to look at in and of themselves. And I like the idea of turning into another person. Mm-hmm. When you're that young and feeling like you're not in your own body, but this just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And frankly, it would have made a really good short film, but it is a bore as long as it is. I appreciate
how long is it?
I don't remember.
8 hours.
Yeah, it seemed like 8 hours. Yeah. It's probably 90 minutes.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't work. And honestly, good try. is what I say because there are. I mean, you can tell this guy
for participation.
He's got skills. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. This is not a poorly put together film. It just doesn't work.
Okay, but maybe you'd be interested in his sophomore feature.
Oh yeah, I'll definitely watch another movie from him. Yeah. Cool. So, but this one, not so much, especially this season.
Minor rock fist?
No, it's a rock fist way down.
Okay.
Ooh.
Yeah. I don't hate it as much as Alan did. He's got bile in his guts for it, but I. Like I said, nice try.
All right. Well, then why don't you guys now tell me about Anna Karenina?
Trey Hawk.
Since I've not.
Well, it's got Keira Knightley, so that was a hurdle for me to overcome.
Does she ever manage to close her mouth?
occasionally. But I will say this. She was very well cast in this.
As a woman who can't close her
mouth. I know that Joe Wright's the director of Anna Karenina, and I know that he's worked with her before.
Atonement.
Right.
Pride and Prejudice.
Exactly.
She is his muse.
Kind of. He and Alan. I'm just going to keep referencing Alan today.
A beating. This isn't
no,
even
I'm
fair.
Not being mean.
Alan's in love with Keira Knightley.
He is in love with Keira Knightley.
Yes. For
good and this is his favorite movie of the year, by the way.
Okay, well then, yeah, go for it.
And you know what? At least he's chosen well. Because this is kind of the film that I've always wanted Joe Wright to make.
You knew he was capable of it.
I knew he's capable of it. And I've always been slightly dissatisfied with his films in the past for one reason or another. With Hannah, he had this very stylistic thriller going up to about the halfway point, and then he just kind of, like, chilled.
Oh, I don't agree with that. But anyway, I like Hannah.
And I think that there are just some real flaws with Hannah, even though there are things about it that I absolutely love.
But let's be clear about this movie. Who's the star? It's not Keira Knightley. It's not Jude Law. It's not any of the actors.
It's the set.
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely.
Explain that.
What Joe Wright does. And I think that a comparison to Peter Greenaway is absolutely in order, because Peter Greenaway, with his kind of opus films,
The Cook, the Thief,
The Wife and Her Lover, and Prospero's Books, where he absolutely makes the setting the character that tells the story, where they're all shot on sound stages, you know that they're on sound stages, and that's kind of what Joe Wright does with this film, where it's all staged in a theater, and
most of it.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Or it's staged to look like you have walked out of the theater onto the plains of Russia, and that theatricality, that overt theatricality, helps to accentuate the artifice of the socioeconomic structure within the book and within the story.
We're talking about 19th century high society in Russia.
Yeah, 1874 Russia.
Leo Tolstoy's famous book and what many people, including William Faulkner and Vladimir Nabokov, have called the most perfect book ever written.
Right.
The interesting thing about this is that we have seen the historical romance tragedy so many times since then, and especially in movies. I'm thinking particularly of Dr. Zhivago and things like that, that this movie plot-wise does not feel fresh. And it was interesting because while I was watching it, I kept thinking, you know, there are so many things about this that are so similar to other stories that I've seen, and I've never seen Anna Karenina before. But the thing that is keeping me interested here is the staging, is the storytelling, and the way that it's reflecting the characters and what's happening to them. It doesn't feel like it's just staged to be staged.
Right.
It feels like he's actually bringing something else up in the moments where there's these incredibly creative transitions between between scenes where the characters are actually moving the sets as they talk or as they exit or enter the scene.
The one that really kind of blew me away as far as... this is just like Home Improvement. The one that really blew me away, that was a moment that absolutely carried content but was embedded in the fact that this takes place in the theater, was when they transition to... Constantine's brother. So you go from the court. Well, he's in one scene.
Yeah.
But you go from the Russian court, which is all down on the main stage of the theater. And then Constantine, one of the supporting characters, climbs up into the rafters of the theater.
Yeah.
And all of these people are kind of like these impoverished people who are cold and, you know, are running the theatrical production down below them and looking down on all of these incredibly wealthy people who basically control their lives and are like shaking and shivering and talking about how this system has got to fall.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was an amazing moment that illustrates the point that we're trying to make, that the setting absolutely is contingent on this story working. And it's a moment where Joe Wright becomes totally overt with his construction.
Yeah, it's not subtle.
Yeah, in a way that I kind of wish he had gotten more hands-on with his Grimm's fairy tale construction within Hannah. Like, I felt like that was just kind of in between, and I wanted him to get really aggressive
with it.
When
they went to the gingerbread house, that was pretty overt.
They did, but it still had to be motivated by this, like, playground area. And so I wanted him, you know, and he does it here. He does it here, and it's totally satisfying. It's really pretty amazing. And the theatricality of the performances of all of the characters. So this is what I'm saying with Keira Knightley. She always has that theatricality to her performance. And
she certainly had it in A Dangerous Method.
Yeah, sure. And you want, you know, at times you want her to tone it down and make it subtle. It absolutely fits.
In this movie, it can't be. It has to.
Absolutely fits within this film. And Jude Law as overly stoic, but theatrically stoic, and every single one of the characters kind of pushes it just a little bit, mm-hmm. and it fits perfectly with the tone of this film. It was really exciting.
So yeah. how do you come down overall?
You know, I will say as excited as I am about this film, I think I have to give it a Rock Fist way up. I think I have to. I think it's my second Rock Fist way up this year.
Nice.
My other one was The Master, and The Master is still my favorite film of the year. But this one is, I mean, it's going to be something that I think a wide audience can get into and accept. You don't think so?
No.
I think it's pretty to look at. The characters are interesting.
I thought you came down way up on Beasts of the...
Oh, yeah, I did. That's true. So three
for the year.
Yeah, three for the year.
I'm going to go solid Rock Fist up and not Rock Fist way up. And the only reason for that is I feel that the story as influential and important as it is and has been through the centuries, I think just feels a little familiar, and that's no fault of Leo Tolstoy's for sure. But emotionally, it didn't engage me on a level that a lot of other movies do. And when I'm separating the cream of the crop, that's unfortunately the one of the things I look for. I guess I'm going to give this a solid, but it's very close to way up for me. And my top 10 this year is going to be really crowded, and this will probably be in there. But man, it's more than just beautiful to look at. We should say it is.
I think
you should
it's going to be
for that, but then on top of that, it actually works.
I think it's going to be for those kind of art cinema inclined folks who are in their mid-20s. This is going to be their Dr. Zhivago.
Well, it's better than Dr. Zhivago, that's for sure. Absolutely. I'm not a fan of that. I love David Lean, but that movie is lumpy, to say the least.
So, yeah. Eric's review, better than Dr. Zhivago.
Absolutely.
My review, just like Home Improvement.
After not seeing it?
After not seeing it, sounds like Home Improvement.
So, those movies are opening wide in Kansas City, opening in one theater. This weekend is Miami Connection, which is a movie from 1987 that Alamo Drafthouse's Zach Carlson bought on eBay for $50 on VHS and watched for the first time after buying it. Drafthouse Films, we should say, actively tries to rescue movies.
Yeah, they have a film division.
Yeah, that are... No, but I mean, like, they actively try to rescue movies that are disappearing.
Right.
And they just buy things to make sure that they should be preserved. And this is one of those films that, had he not seen it and realized that it was something special, would have been lost to the annals of time, or maybe the annals of time.
Stuck in the annals.
But basically, if you've ever seen Troll 2, which was also very much trumpeted by the Drafthouse people and its cult resurgence, they had a lot to do with. Then you understand the idea that bad movies are not, we don't enjoy bad movies simply because they're bad. There are a ton of bad movies out there that are a slog to watch and they are no fun.
Like Jack and Diane.
They're cynical. Well, no, I'm talking like, when I say bad, I mean like inept.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like they're ineptly put
together.
Poorly
crafted. Yeah.
And certainly Ed Wood would be the most widely known example of that.
The director, not the Tim Burton.
Right. But here's the thing. So Miami Connection has what Troll 2 has.
Mm-hmm.
And it is this very special thing where you realize that the people putting it together, there's two elements. The people putting it together did so with the ultimate care and genuine love for what they were doing. This was not a joke to them. They tried really hard.
Right.
The second thing is that you have this lost in translation element. So where Troll 2 was directed by an Italian who spoke very little English and cast all these American actors and was trying to make a statement about vegetarianism in a horror movie, you have a Taekwondo master who is in Orlando, who runs a Taekwondo school and has all these students and decides that he needs to make this movie and who speaks very little English, very broken English, and has almost no charisma in the movie. It's amazing. And he wants to make this film not because he is a big fan of movies. He's, in fact, only seen six before making this. He wants to create something that he thinks will bring the world to Taekwondo.
Uh-huh.
And there is a quote at the very end of this movie, which has extreme violence in it, a cheesy violence, of course,
but, yeah,
you know, severed limbs and blood spurting and things like that, and multiple biker women breasts, which are just disgusting, and non-actors getting naked on camera.
Oh, no, I'm not a fan of that at
all. At the end of this movie, there's a quote about Taekwondo and or not Taekwondo, but about world peace. I'm not fucking kidding. And so people who enjoy people who know how films are created, like us, people who have and I think almost these days anybody who's ever played with any editing software,
yeah,
will really get a kick out of this film because there's so many overdubbed lines. There's so many, like, what do they call it? ADR?
Yeah.
Where it's just, it doesn't match at all.
Yeah.
And you can tell that there were scenes that were put in there like John Waters does in Pink Flamingos when he realizes that he doesn't have a transition and he needs to make sense in the plot. Mm-hmm. And he'll just have people overdub over, like, cityscapes.
Yeah.
People talking.
Yeah.
And we don't know who those people are or anything. There's tons of stuff like that in this movie. But what really sells it is this positive attitude. And it's so bizarre because there is a band.
I was going to say.
Yeah, this is another thing.
Isn't there like a ninja,
yes,
ninja band?
Yes.
Yes.
Dragon Sound. And Dragon Sound plays at a club. And I didn't understand the plot because it doesn't make any sense.
Good. Yeah.
It's called Miami Connection. It takes place in Orlando. But for some reason, this band gets this job at this club, and the band that they replace is so angry that they want to beat them up.
Okay.
And somehow the band that they've replaced are friends with a group of drug lord ninjas from Miami.
That's the
Miami Connection.
They've got a Miami Connection.
And so this whole thing is started because this band that sings about friendship and ninjas in a positive way is somehow set against these drug lords, and, especially towards the end of the film when the bodies keep piling up, and nobody seems to like
notice. There are no cops.
Yeah, and at the end, there's just this total like, well, everything turned out great. You know? But
at least we all won.
The acting is worse than the acting in Troll 2.
Wow.
And you can tell that these people really have no business being in a movie at all, and some of them have faces for radio, and it's just pretty. Now, here's the thing: it doesn't. For some reason, there are scenes that go a little long, and that's kind of the, you know what I mean. Like, there's moments where when you see one of those movies like this, and you're looking at it for that reason, it gets a little bit hard to take. And there are moments like that. So this is not quite as good as Troll 2.
Not for the faint of heart.
No,
you have to be into this type of movie.
But. If going into it, they play, before the film starts, they play a little infomercial of YK Kim, who's the guy behind this whole thing. and about his taekwondo for, you know, for moral support and financial support, and these are all the reasons. And then it says YK Kim not appearing or something like that.
Yes.
Apparently he, you know, he was at a lot of these early screenings of the film, and he's been at some of them.
Uh-huh.
So now here's another thing. I saw this by myself,
right,
on a screener at home.
Yep.
If you see this, go tonight. Mm-hmm. It's Friday night. It opens at the Draft House tonight. Go tonight when there's probably the biggest crowd, or this weekend, because this is a movie that you will want to see with a crowd. I can only imagine how much more fun it would be to watch.
They're hooting and hollering.
Yeah, laughing together. Yeah, yeah.
There's a scene where this guy opens his mailbox and gets a letter.
Yeah, they put that in the trailer.
Is it in the trailer?
Yeah, it's at the end of the trailer.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, so.
Find the trailer. It's on iTunes. You can, if you have an Apple TV, it's
but
in
what
the,
happened?
The
I have not seen this trailer.
You can find it.
Dragon Sound is apparently a band made up of orphans. And at one point he says, "Well, I wanted to tell you about my father." And then YK Kim says, "But I thought we were all orphans." And that's how that gets brought in. That.
Uh-huh.
And then he opens the thing and finds out that his father is alive and he's found him.
Uh-huh.
And there's this tearful, like, I mean, it's just dude is trying really hard to act. And the other guys are really excited about the fact that he found his father. And they pick him up. And they go, yay! And it's like this scene where they got him on their shoulders. And they're like, yeah, let's go. You know, yay! Yeah, it's insane. And it's just, it's so wrong in every way that it's right, you know? And so anyway, kudos to Zach Carlson and the Draft House people for finding another film that that threw all of the cynical, cash-driven, you know, crappy B-movies out there. And you know, Hollywood A-movies, which are basically B-movies, Battleship and whatnot, crap like that. To find a movie that is like those films, but motivated by a completely different thing, and you can tell.
Yeah.
It's motivated by love, it's full of ineptitude, and it is just it's pretty awesome. Yeah. And I think there's more than one way to enjoy a film. And this movie is one of those that proves that. So if you get a chance to see Miami Connection, it probably won't be here very long. But I would recommend it, especially with a crowd. It's tough, and it's also an antidote maybe to all the Oscar movies.
Yeah. Nice bit of counter-programming to all this heavy-handed.
And the songs are repeated throughout the movie, so you get to know them
Fight
very
the
well
ninjas.
By the end. Yeah.
Fight the Ninjas.
Yeah, the two main songs, which were co-written by two of the actors that are in the band in the film. One of them is a total John Oates. Like, they're a Hall John Oates lookalike. Oh, and I should also mention that these guys aren't wearing shirts for much of the film.
Sure, well, yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like every video game from the 80s, like Double Dragon, you know, mm-hmm. where, like, the girlfriend's been kidnapped and they have to fight through a bunch of moronic thugs.
I just have to mention, people, you can tune out. It's a half hour. The podcast is essentially over. But I have to mention the scene where Dragon Force is on stage playing.
Dragon Force, the bad guys?
No, the good
Dragon
guys.
Dragon Sound.
Dragon Sound.
Okay.
Dragon Sound is on stage playing, singing their positive songs about friendship. And they're joking around with each other. And the way that they joke around with each other is that YK Kim lifts up his leg and plays "I Got Your Nose" with his toes to a fellow band member during the song. They're like joking around, "Hey!" And he's using his feet. And he's like, "Got your nose," while they're playing the song. It's absurd. And you can tell that all these people in this movie look up to this guy.
Yeah.
And I'll bet he has charisma in real life. But he can't not act. And he's like, he's 15 years older than everybody in the movie, and they're all supposed to be college students. In fact, they come out of their apartment, and they're all wearing the university's T-shirt. Like five
well,
of
how
them.
How else are you going to know that they're college students?
Yeah, they're either shirtless or they're wearing
their college T-shirt. They're orphans, man.
Yeah. And people,
what do you want?
People get into conflicts for no reason. They go from 0 to 10 in 1 second.
That's awesome.
You fired us. Yeah, well, you guys shouldn't have sucked so bad. Well, blah, 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 boom, boom. And then they're fighting. It's like, how did we get here? What happened here?
Some anger issues.
Yeah. Right. I bet this would be really fun with a crowd. I'm kind of kind of sad that I had to watch it by myself.
Oh.
So. Yeah. Anyway, Miami Connection.
What, are you going to do any sort of rock fest on this, or is this kind of...
Yeah, no, this is solid rock fest. This is better than half the movies I've seen this year. Like I said, there's more than one way to enjoy a film, and it's thoroughly entertaining, except when it's not.
Right.
Which
is less little, often than...
It, Troll 2 is a rock fest way up. That movie's brilliant. This is not quite Troll 2.
Yeah.
So...
All right. Well, good. Overall, another positive week of movies for us. We're going to go. Everybody go see Miami Connection, it sounds like. Killing Them Softly and Anna Karenina. Skip Jack and Diane. And we'll be back next week with some more.